So while we're waiting for the graphics, maybe you can, seeing this as an informal talk, I'll go into a little bit more detail than I normally do.
This could be on the chat.
That's right. You're being eternalized there.
That's right. All those rumors you were studying about David Gross are now recorded.
So on 4-pi convolution, and the point is that it's fast 4-pi convolution. The topic and. And so the idea is the following. Actually, for the for the idea, I guess, see if you're already online. Table. Okay, so the idea is that you have two functions on the sphere. I use this notation where gamma is a unit vector. And I call them B and S functions. And this is the idea is that this is some kind of a beam, and this is some kind of a sky. This is the motivation for this. For starting to think about this problem, but in general, talking about beams and skies does not imply in any way that any one of them has to be positive, definite, or they can just be arbitrary functions on the sphere. But they have the following property that's important, at least for it to be true, approximately, and then they need to have this property. So both of them. Write F for both of them for now. And the property that they need is that they write the sum from L going, you can write them like this. Okay, this is called band limitation. The point is that up here I can expand them in spherical harmonics, these are the usual spherical harmonics over there. And the point is that this maximum, that there's a maximum L here, beyond which is at least approximately all the terms which are beyond this maximum L here don't contribute very much. So basically, that this includes all non-pathological functions, I mean everything that we normally think about. Or actually, all the physical functions would be included. Some mathematical functions do have topologies. So,
how useful it will depend on Lmax?
What's this?
How your efficiency of algorithm will depend on Lmax?
Oh, this, yeah, I'll talk about computational stuff later. The scaling of the method will have the dependence on Lmax. Yes. Obviously, the higher Lmax is, the more detailed is the function. The more points you need to represent it, the more bits. Of these numbers here, you need to represent it, so that's all these things are interconnected. So, and the idea is now that, for some reason, this doesn't seem to come up. Yeah, it should be. Only is. Maybe I need to restart it. Oh dear.
Hello.
You need to configure the computer to put it after that port. Right? It's one of the function keys.
Yeah, but normally it just does the automatically.
Just start with the function.
Okay, well, thank you. No, just leave it. No, <I'm kidding.
laughs> You could just turn it around and look at the screen.
Okay, there we go. All right. ad break again. IBM. So my sponsor. So and the idea is now that we have the problem is to compute scalar products. So here's of the function V and S over the sphere. Okay, so Microsoft is not my sponsor. And the idea is that you have a beam, this beam function, and you move it around over the sphere in some way, and you just want to compute scalar products at every point. This is what you then, the number that comes out is the voltage that you see in your receiver, okay, in your feed horn. So, and if you did this just in a straightforward way, if you have B and S represented as pixels on the sphere, then obviously the scalar product that you want to compute, let's call them T, and if we think about temperature, that's where that comes from. And of course, you can the orientation of the beam with respect to the sky, I'm thinking of the beam as the thing that's moving around and keeping the sky fixed. The orientation of the beam with respect to the sky is uniquely identified in terms of three Euler angles. All right, so you have, I hope that people are familiar with what Euler angles are. Okay, and then, so I write these temperatures that I get, or the voltages that I get, as in my receiver, as the integral over the sphere, over solid angle, of just the beam, but the beam is now rotated, so I have a rotation operator here acting on the beam. Okay, this one's acting on the beam now. Okay. Now that function evaluated at some orientation, at some direction. This gamma is varying over omega. So this is 2 gamma times the sky. Okay. So this is essentially the integral that we want to solve. And if you look at
just a direct product by convolution.
So the point is that, well, at each we're evaluating the scalar product. It's a scalar product, right? We're summing over all directions. This would be the scalar product of the sky. There's an integral here. And we're doing that for all possible orientations. Now, if you have, in the context of a CMB mission, for example, these Euler angles encode, you can encode the scanning strategy in terms of these Euler angles, by just saying, you know, you have three tuples, like that, and they're a function of t. Okay, so that's your scanning strategy. Your scanning strategy is just a set of Euler angles for each time. Okay, and that tells you how your beam is moving around the sky. It's completely arbitrary. So. That's trying to make sense.
So can I do?
Yeah.
What did you have? The beam is symmetric at this point, right? You're not assuming that the beam is
symmetric. Oh, no. This is already. And this comes out in. Here, this is completely general.
Right. Are you assuming a particular orientation of the beam at this combination of Euler angles?
No.
The rotation operator of the Euler angles on the beams. Oh, so we have two angles for a place in the sphere and one angle for a.
Oh, that's yeah. How you choose your Euler angle convention is up to you.
Good.
Right. So there are many Euler angle conventions.
It's a total power. It's just a total power. I mean, scan, no chomp.
That's right. So I just take
one beam.
One beam. Okay. Yeah. You could think about, you know, this function B. As long as it's band limit, you can do anything you like. You can have a positive lobe sitting somewhere and a negative lobe sitting somewhere else, and that's a differential measurement, right?
And the orientation.
And yeah, then you just have to choose these Euler angles. The Euler angles just tell you, and one simple way of looking at it is just it tells you a position in the sky, and the orientation of objects in some other time sense. These are actually slightly different. So maybe at this point it would be good to have some graphics. Actually, you're getting the benefits of some equations. I usually don't have equations in my talks because it's kind of too much detail usually. Here's just another representation of this. In terms of the particular coordinates that end up being useful for the maps, this is maybe somebody will eventually get the code from me and they look at it. This might be useful. But just in terms of the angles, what you have is a beam. So here's a sphere. Here is a beam looking at some particular direction. And the coordinates that I've chosen here is a particular convenient coordinatization of this, which is that you have something like a spin axis, this guy up here. The spin axis moves along the sky. For example, at an elevation, this elevation here, the function. And then there's some opening, some ring with some opening angle around it, and this beam is moving on these rings, and the orientation, and then there's an additional freedom, which is the beam orientation. So in the limit where the spin axis moves on the equator, this opening angle here is just 90 degrees, you recover what I just said. You have some slightly non-standard coordinates on the sphere which just tell you where you're looking and what the orientation about that, or what orientation of the beam about the axis is, mm-hmm. omega. But I mean, I'm just keeping it slightly more general. I can have smaller rings as well, going at arbitrary elevations. That just turns out to make things more efficient. For example, if you want to do a small patch, you don't really want to cover the whole sphere. I'm just keeping this freedom in the system. It's an additional freedom. Okay, and I guess the point is that if you can think about it very simply. If you have structure in these functions which need n pixels to resolve, okay, then you can think of having roughly square root of n pixels on the equator, okay, and square root of n also from pole to pole. So there are n orientations on the sky. And square root of n distinct orientations about each axis. Okay, so that's n to the 3/2 objects you want to compute, and for each object you need to sum over n pixels. Right, so you have n to the 5/2 operations that you need to perform, or in terms of this band limit, that's L max to the 5. The band limit is just the square root of the number of pixels, if speaking. Or scaled at the square root of the number of pixels. So if you just do this in the pedestrian way, then your scaling is like so. You have the number of pixels to 2/2 operations. Now, of course, if the number of pixels is large, that's a very large number. So for 10 million pixels or so, this places you into supercomputing territory. So, and of course you need to do this for each horn, because each horn will have a slightly, if you have a several horns in your focal plane for CMB experiment, each horn will have a slightly different beam pattern, and because it's sitting at a different place in the focal plane, it'll also scan over slightly different positions in the sky. So this is the, if you have several horns, it's quite a lot to do. So here's an example, which is again part of the motivation why we studied this, is because we wanted to compute what the effect is of side lobes of Planck beams in this particular case on the ability to do CMB mapping. And of course, one point is that we have a very bright source in the sky, the galactic center, and it's a bright extended source that has a lot of structure. And if your side lobe sits on that galactic center, you suck up power for that. And the question is how much and what's being quantified. Now, here's not the side lobe, but we've shown this picture. You see there's a lot of structure in this. This is the main lobe, the inner 5 degrees of the worst Planck beam in the present, actually not in the present configuration, this is slightly outdated, but still, you see there's a lot of structure there. Here's the rest of the sphere, what you just saw sits in this little disk up there. So there's a lot of structure out here, patches and so on. So this, and we really want to keep all the structure. We don't want to.
But how much of the power is coming from outside the main lobe?
Well, that's exactly the question we want to answer.
Well, no, I mean, you know that's
the power.
The beam efficiency of the.
It's just by integrating this stuff here compared to integrating the main.
Oh, you mean the directivity? Well, how much power comes from there depends, of course, on what source you have, right?
No.
And how you point.
I mean,
what you mean is
for a uniform sphere.
Yeah.
For a uniform sphere. Okay, so then.
I mean, these are just torn, so.
Yeah, I know. So I,
well,
I didn't put. So the highest point on here, which is.
Yeah. Okay.
Have a look.
Well, it's very small.
It's very small.
It's very bright.
That's why you care. So I mean, if you look at this, this is what it looks like at the highest point on that sphere.
Yeah.
Okay. I just
But the previous plot had -80 dB at that cap.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but some of these are slightly higher. So, but they're about down by 60 dB or so.
Yeah.
So it's the highest points in that plot. Red is. And so in 1999 we developed a fast-Fourier method for doing these exact convolutions for arbitrary beam patterns. At that point, we're still thinking about particular kind of scan path. And these basic scan paths. It turns out that for such scan paths, so now we've eliminated the degree of freedom of being able to rotate the beam, you know, at each position here about arbitrarily. Now we're just keeping the beam fixed, but it's moving with respect to the sky on these scan paths, and the anisotropy of the beam is fully kept in the problem. For such basic scan paths, the scaling is reduced to number of pixels to the 1/2, so it's a factor of the number of pixels down from the general computation. So that's a massive scaling improvement. So this is already being used in the Planck simulation pipeline. So I already showed this animation last talk. The idea is that you take these rings and you unwrap them like that, and then you have some kind of a cylinder, and actually they link up at the end, so it gives you a torus. And then it turns out that when you then straighten them up again and look at the result, so these are now the rings, but unfolded as I just showed you, going this is in time direction. Emission time goes upwards, and. So here you see the Haslam map put through this diabolical machine, and comes out like so. So you, as you're scanning for that particular horn, so actually these lines here correspond to some rings around the ring around the North Pole. This line here corresponds to the ring around the South Pole, which are the most northern and southern points that this horn ever scans on the sphere. And then as you go on each ring, you're essentially doing this, okay, on the sphere. So you see the galaxy twice, and particularly you see it a little bit differently due to the peculiarities of the beam. And if you do this so that was for the main beam. This was for the inner 5 degrees. Now, if you cut out the main beam and just do the same exercise for this. For the side lobe pattern, then you get a result like this. There's one main side lobe, which lines up with the spin axis, and you can see the effect very clearly here, that this side lobe rotates on the galactic center, essentially, for a set of rings here. Very close to the galactic center. So on these rings here, you always have a large pickup through that side lobe that aligns the spin axis. There's some other features here, too.
If you're relying on knowing your minus 30 dB side lobes, which presumably
minus 60 dB.
How confident are you that anything you do on the ground will mean anything once you get it up there?
Well, so there are other methods that we do to extract the beam pattern from your map, from your scans. But it's of course hard to do that when you're so far down.
We might want to use that time period when you're observing the galactic center time state to see what kind of side lobe you have.
But the thing is, you don't know what the true signal is.
Yeah.
Well, you know it when you come back to the same point on the. So the point is that, of course, there is information about the beam. So of course, there is information about the beam encoded in the time series. And that's shown, I mean, this is what I showed just now. I mean, the anisotropies in the beam produce these features that are in the second slide just now. So, of course, there is some way you can extract some information from this.
Those are a very large, long time scale in the spin, right? Because you're stuck in a red band all the way around your spin.
Yes.
Right.
So it's an offset.
It's not well modulated during the spin, so in fact it'll probably just be filtered out, right? To a large degree.
It's essentially an offset.
Yeah.
It's an offset that can be. Yeah. I mean, these rings here intersect on the sky between these rings. So when you sort of solve for your map, it will have, there'll be some. Even if you do just stupidly by doing a card grid, at least reduce some of this. Of course, the point is to put in the information that you have about the beam to help you.
But I worry that you won't have good information, so you're better off not even including it.
So there are some, based on the methods that have been used to produce this, you can use the same kinds of ideas, which I'll get back to on the blackboard. To formulate the inverse problem of getting out the sky given the beam, or getting out the beam given the sky, or even an iterative scheme where you try to get out both self-consistently from the scan. And it turns out that at least if you know what the beam is, you get the sky out down to machine precision. Getting the beam out is a little harder, but that's due to peculiarities of the scanning strategy. So here's the dust. We took the dust emission at 100 gigahertz, even though it's not supposed to be very important there, but just the point is that we have the power now to do very high resolution work because of these methods, but we don't have templates, and we don't know enough about the foreground to model things in detail. So we just took the dust emission and ran the 30 gigahertz beam over it, because that's what we had. So you see a lot more structure here, huh? Same kind of thing. You don't really see any differences by eye. And here's what it looks like when you're reprojected on the sky in the Mollweiler projection. This is what comes through the main beam, the inner 5 degrees. And you see that these bits here around the ecliptic poles are not seen by this horn. Here's the contribution from the side lobes. There's now a little bit more structure, simply because the map has more structure in it. Okay, and so then this was what you saw now is what in terms of basic scan paths, which gives you this large factor improvement. If you have a perturbation around basic scan paths, let's say you wiggle your scan axis up and down a little bit, cover more sky, or to have more interconnections and so on, then there's something which is already implemented also in the Planck pipeline, where you can have processing scan paths, so your spin axis does this, and you just decompose it in terms of basic scan paths at several elevations, and then you just pick out rings at the elevations where you want it going around the sky. And this is working. So that's, and you know, you lose that efficiency by the amount of variation you have in theta. But you're still much faster than if you did it in the pedestrian way. So we also have this completely general fast Fourier convolution method that I started describing on the blackboard here, with where you just have three Euler angles. And the point turns out that there you can take advantage very nicely of if you have slowly varying as a musical structure in the beam, which is obviously what you're trying to achieve, or what is mostly the case in real situations. So you know, there are various efficiencies also there that you can build in for special kinds of beams which are not completely asymmetrically symmetric but only have little structure. So the point now is that maybe for those people, what this method gives back is, say, you take a basic scan path which covers the whole sphere, and then so at each point where you're looking, so you grid this, right, in terms of this. So at each point you have a little needle sticking out, and then at each point, because you have the freedom of orientation about this point, you have a little ring sitting on it which gives you the information for all the different orientations of your beam. So this actually represents a grid, not on the sphere but on the group of rotations in the SO3. So this is, and it turns out that, yeah, indeed, SO3 is just S2 across T1, or across SO2. So the point is that the group of rotation is simply, so this is, what I'm trying to say is that this covers the group of rotation fully, so all arbitrary rotations are included. And so we conjectured this initially, it's been now proven, and there's a preprint coming out soon, where we show that this doesn't just work for temperature but also for tensor fields on the sphere, so you can do this polarization as well. So anyway, that's it. Now let me, if you want some more details. Do I have time?
Yeah.
Some more details on the maths behind this. And so the trick is, and I really, so you can see this scaling here too, right? This is n pixel operations to do this integral, and then there are n pixels with 3/2 distinct orientations, so you get n pixels with 5/2 operations to compute this generally. Scan strategies are encoded as just a function of time of Euler angles. This is completely general. So what you do is, you compute these. The point is really about applying the rotation matrices here. And it turns out that a very convenient way of splitting this rotation matrix, addressing the problem by splitting the rotation matrix. So you do a factorization. It's actually well known, certainly didn't discover that. And you can think about it in two ways. So you do split like that, acting on the beam. And let's think about it this way. So you have a beam, you start off with a beam looking towards the North Pole. Okay? So the first thing you can do is you rotate it about its axis. Right? And so that's the first thing you do, you rotate it about its axis. Oh. Why is that important? Well, that turns out to give you that additional freedom at the end where you can have any arbitrary orientation about it, about each point. So then you take that and you rotate it off the pole by some angle. Or the angle theta. Okay, so now you've got this beam in some orientation off the pole at some angle. Then at that angle, there's a whole ring of equal latitude that you can then move your beam on. So when you can do that by a further rotation in as a mutual direction by a phi. Okay, so this now you now have a beam which has an arbitrary orientation going around on a ring at equal latitude. Now this whole ring you can then rotate, so you can do nothing. So this outer angle here is an Abelian rotation. You do nothing with it, and then you rotate this whole ring onto the sphere, for example, onto the equator, or wherever you want. So you do a theta rotation, a polar rotation of this whole ring downwards. Theta e. Okay, so now this whole ring rotated downwards, and this whole ring you can now rotate around the sphere. Okay, and this is the final rotation phi. So this, in terms of the convolution coordinates that I showed you, described in words what this picture said. So this is what you end up with. Right? You first did an orientation of the beam around an axis, then you rotated it onto a ring, then you rotated the whole ring down, and you rotated the ring about the sphere. So why is this advantageous? So the point is that this is advantageous because it turns out that it's very efficient, it's very easy in Fourier space to do azimuthal rotations. So these matrices here have a representation. These are rotating in pixel space, but they're a representation. In L and M space, in spherical harmonic space, which is sparse in particular. If you're rotating first by an angle, dividing this one first, hit an angle omega azimuthally, then you rotate, this does a theta rotation, and then you rotate by another angle azimuthally. So, because these are just exponentials, the things that do azimuthal rotations are just exponentials. The azimuthal part is very easily computed, and it turns out that you can encode it in terms of Fourier transforms once you write this all out. These guys here are just Wigner D functions, which can be computed. The efficient recursion relations for them. So combining all of this, combining all the fact that these are exponentials, and the key idea of the split. In terms of the split of the rotation matrix, this convolution decouples, and it turns out that for particular values of the particular scan paths, you get the very high gains in efficiency, but even for the most general case, where you fix this and this to pi over 2, then phi e and omega coordinatize the whole group of rotations, the finite rotations on the sphere. And you see that omega phi and phi e just correspond to azimuthal rotations once you've done the split. So this is basically the reason why this works.
Are you enjoying doing this?
This is why I don't normally have this in my talks. But that's essentially the.
And if you only had to worry about sort of the inner 2 degrees of the beam, for example, suppose it miraculously cut off at that point.
Yeah.
What sort of scale calculation would you have? Or would you go to some complicated method like this, or would you sort of brute force this?
There is, of course, some point. I mean, if you have, in the limit where your beam is just it's just one pixel big. Right there, you gain massively, and doing something like this is not useful anymore.
I'd say a couple hundred pixels. your beams that come.
Yes, so that just depends
100
on
by 100.
How much structure there is in it.
Right.
There's a lot of structure on the beam. You actually have to oversample it sufficiently so that this,
right.
it's computing this integral here.
But on the other hand, the scale of structure in the beam scales with the radius.
Scales.
You don't have believable fine structure in the beam far out. So I would see breaking the beam problem up by scale.
Okay,
and
so
do a low resolution version for the far side lobes, and then do a high resolution version only in the inner parts of the beam.
Right.
And I'd have to think something like that in the end would be tractable.
Well, so that's a very clever idea,
yeah.
And people have been trying to be clever like that,
and does it work?
And they have implemented this, and it works very nicely, but it takes about 2 weeks to run one of those things, and it takes 50 minutes to run the whole sphere, so that's the bottom line.
And let's keep supposing that this corresponds to maybe some fractional prefecture for one of your end picks. I mean, instead of jamming the beam on the whole sphere with all the side lobes, you think you can ignore side lobes but still count the structure of the beam. So, I mean, your method...
But so what they did, so this is Carlo Borigana and Davide Maino, and they take a very fine grid, resolving the structure just around the peak. Exactly.
Yeah.
Like you're suggesting, and then they take an intermediate grid resolving right. the structure in the middle, and then they take a coarse grid resolving
right.
the structure on most of the sphere. And
you can't get enough gain.
And it just turns out that when you do that, it's just the fact is that fast Fourier methods are surprisingly powerful.
It's like if it's cheap, if you have a function with lots of zeros, it's still
sure.
quite often.
Right.
Well, you don't gain extra points by doing it exact when there's much larger uncertainties in the beam that you do it. At least if you decompose, here it's just all mucked together. And I'd worry that unless you have a handle on where, you know, if you're getting results that are depending on the outer parts of the beam, I wouldn't believe them.
But if this is so fast, just run it with it without the other part.
Okay, you know, but...
You have to agree with players. You have to try and measure the other parts of the beam from the table.
My guess is, in the end, you'll ignore the other parts of the beam. Because they'll be on long span time scale. I mean, I think it's great. Actually, where I think the big game is in the simulation. So you put in this exact supposed beam, and then make an approximation and see how well you do.
Right.
How
so do you have to this exercise was part of the simulation pipeline.
That's right. That my guess is it will not be part of the analysis pipeline.
So it turns out that, yes, I mean, I don't know how that's going to go, but just from a mathematical point of view, the same idea of splitting the phase changes and exploiting the ease at which you can do azimuthal rotations turns out to be useful also when you write down analysis problems. It's just several matrices that occur end up having a fast, you can act on these matrices on that vector is much faster than you would otherwise. So there's still hope.
Okay.
Any questions?
Thank you.
I thought it was a favor. I'll tell you my problem.